Welcome to Vistage Live, the place you can come to for insights, knowledge and perspectives from a range of experts who can help your small and mid-sized business make a great big impact. Today's guest is Dr. Ben Hamer, an accredited futurist and recognized as the number one thought leader on the future of work in the Asia Pacific. Formerly head of future of work at PwC Australia, Ben has led projects for the World Economic Forum, been a visiting scholar at Yale, and now serves as an adjunct professor at Edith Cowan University. He's also a sometime magician as well that we might hear a bit about this morning. Ben Hamer, welcome to Vistage Live.
Thanks so much for having me. I've got my coffee. We're set up. We're good to go.
Yeah, we're good to go. And you look like a futurist too, which is great.
As we said, you got the t-shirt and the smartwatch and you can fool anyone with anything.
You can predict anything.
Yeah.
Magician? Better go there. Tell me about that.
Yes. Yeah, so we were just talking about this before we went live, right? So I'm doing a lot of research at the moment on curiosity. So I've been fortunate. It's taken me all over the world talking to really interesting people. And now that I'm starting to bring that research back and talk to people here in Australia about it and share some of those findings, I thought about, well, it's not just necessarily talking to curiosity, but it's also in what you do. So I did a keynote on stage the other week, several hundred people, all under the age of 30, which is terrifying. And I did a magic trick for the first time. So that was quite interesting. I was saying I Googled what is the most impressive but easiest to learn magic trick, and I made a water bottle disappear.
Right. Good. And they were impressed, I'm assuming.
Well, yeah, they were impressed until someone in the Q&A asked how I went about making it happen. And I said, well, I'm not a magician, so I don't really care. I'll tell you. And then they were wildly disappointed at how easy it was.
Right,
so okay. From that point in time, I said, maybe I will keep my secrets like a true magician.
Nice. Talk to me about curiosity. It's such a valuable trait in a person, isn't it?
Yeah. So I guess why I was really fascinated by it was because in my line of work, right, as a futurist, a lot of the time working with organizations, they are continually wanting to know, how do I stay future fit, future ready? What are the skills I need for the future? And, you know, you can read countless Harvard Business Review articles, LinkedIn blogs, you know, so many different career books, self-help books, but they'll tell you 50 different things. And that can be quite overwhelming for someone. And so I found that when you cut through it all and when I observe the most successful organizations, the most successful and high-performing individuals who are able to thrive rather than just survive in and amongst all of this disruption, it really just came down to curiosity. So curiosity in terms of people curiosity, so really wanting to understand humans, where someone's coming from, why a particular colleague might ask a particular question in a meeting, in terms of your customers, not assuming what they want, but actually talking to them and understanding the drivers behind that as well. You know, things like strategic curiosity, where people were looking beyond their immediate industry and looking out more broadly to the market and looking at you know, how different mega trends collide. So say if they work in healthcare, well, what's the impact of climate change on healthcare? Or what's the impact of AI in healthcare? And having those conversations and not just getting caught up in the day-to-day. And discovery curiosity, you know, this idea that we should always continually be pushing ourselves to try something new. And I think a lot of the time we're often doing things based on the idea of whether or not we'll get enjoyment out of it. But this whole notion of discovery curiosity is based on the idea that you'll always learn something new when you step outside your lane. It's not about whether or not you'll enjoy it. It's, can you learn something? And so, you know, I really encourage people to follow Instagram accounts they wouldn't normally follow, or listen to a podcast from someone that, you know, you disagree with, that you know that you have a fundamental values misalignment with, but listen to understand, not listen to agree, but listen to understand. And all of this around curiosity has just continually fascinated me. And so, you know, I, as I said, I think that it's the number one thing we need to be future ready. My whole purpose and mission and why is to help organizations and people prepare now for what's next. And so that's sort of where that was born and where it's going.
Great. Thank you. And it brings together so much of who you are. And even leadership, you know, a good leader is curious and isn't about having the answers. So I've been thinking about the term futurist, because it's actually not a new term. '70s or '80s, I can remember my father really being into futurists and what they were talking about. What kind of defines a futurist, and how did you get into this? And let me ask three questions, not just two. I know. You've got your coffee. I'll prompt you if you need to. And then the future of work is kind of something newer, I guess. So let's start. Let's unpack it. What defines a futurist?
Discipline of futurism. I need to really get better at this because I get asked this question a lot, and I swear I don't have it down pat. So, in terms of what's a futurist, right? So if you go back to when you were talking about the 70s and 80s, one of the most famous futurists was a guy called Alvin Toffler.
That's right.
Like the godfather of the discipline. And I think it was a long time ago, maybe even in the 60s. He said that the illiterate of the 21st century won't be those who can't read and write. It'll be those who can't learn, unlearn, and relearn, which, talking to that notion of curiosity, I think is so true. And that was coming from someone, you know, almost, 60 plus years ago. So in terms of what futurists are, foresight as the discipline, it's really about identifying signals of change from today. So a signal of change being something that gives you an indication that something could be different in the future. So it's not a trend. A trend is something that's here and now and it's happening. A signal precedes a trend.
Right.
So a signal is that light bulb moment where you go, you know, it could become a trend. And you start to ask those questions, well, what if this were to become more common? What would happen if X, happened as a result of that? What are the second and third order impacts? So if this happened, then this could happen and then that could happen. And being able to articulate scenarios and develop forecasts off the back of that. And as futurists, we tend to, our sweet spot is really 10 years into the future. And I think that's where it differs to traditional organizational strategy or someone who works in strategy, where you tend to work, well, it used to be 3 to 5 years. Now I'd say it's 1 to 3 years with what I'm seeing. And also in terms of organizational strategy, you tend to look backwards to look forward. So you look at the last, 3-5 years, what's the trend up until now? And then you project forwards from there. Whereas as a futurist, what you do is you start 10 years into the future, and then rather than forecast, you backcast. So you say, if this is where, what we're going to look like and where the world's going to be in 10 years' time, well, what does that mean in 7 years, in 5 years, in 3 years, in today? What's the preferred future that we want for our children, for our organization, whatever it might be? And then how do we get there, and how do we avoid the kind of futures that we don't want? So we don't just talk about the utopia or the desired future state. We also talk about the negative implications or the negative sort of outcomes that could come from X, Y, and Z. And as I said, how do we work to avoid that?
So back to signals.
Mm.
And I have heard you talk about this before. What are the kinds of signals that a business leader could be scanning for now to get an idea of what trends could be coming to affect their workplace?
So a signal could be a new law. It could be a new technology. It could be a new behavior. And so it really could be anything. For me, the easiest way to describe it is if someone is reading the newspaper or, these days looking at it online on their phones, and they see a headline and they just stop and they pause and they go, huh. Like, to me, that's a sign that that's probably a signal. So if I think about something like, it's really hard to sort of think 3 to 5 plus years, right? But if we go something like AI today, so everyone's talking about generative AI, right? So for me, a signal was maybe about a month ago from now. So Walmart and OpenAI, they announced an agreement whereby you can buy and make purchases directly within ChatGPT. So for me, that's a signal, because then I start to extrapolate, well, what could that look like? And you go, well, all of a sudden, we will get to a point whereby Google is not the preferred search engine, that it will be people already using Perplexity and others for search, But not only that, you will simply search within and buy within the app. So it could say, I want a new pair of sneakers. ChatGPT will give me a list of sneakers. And then I'll say, I want that pair there. And it will make the purchase within two clicks. It's all done. It's taken me 30 seconds as opposed to hours of research if you're me trying to buy something online. But then what does that mean? Well, it means, what does that mean around search engine optimization? Mm. You know, marketers are always about how do we become top of the list on a Google search? Well, actually, it's how do you influence the large language model and the algorithm so that you're recommended as the preferred option? What does that mean in terms of how organizations communicate with customers? Because at the same time, we're going to see the rise of agentic AI, so AI agents who, you know, we're all going to have our own personal AI agents as well. So like our own virtual assistant, and brands are then going to have to start selling directly to their customer's agent, not directly to the customer themselves. So that's sort of an example of where a headline came about. And then rather than just go, oh, that's interesting, you know, I then started to think about, well, what are the plausible future states that could come from this?
And that's the difference, isn't it? That a leader or anyone could see the signal and go either way.
Mm.
They could go to, huh, cynicism, I know better, this won't work, this is bad, or curiosity, exploration, extrapolation. They're kind of different paths. That point that you could go either way, I guess.
Oh, totally. And I think what's interesting with that, though, so I gave you an example of one that's that I'm pretty confident about, because obviously I want to sound good. But a lot of the time, when you're doing this as well, just because I said that, it doesn't mean that it's going to come to fruition.
No,
I mean that's one that is likely to.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are others where there could be a much lower likelihood. And I think that the challenge that we have, particularly as leaders, is that increasingly over time we value efficiency. Mm. And so when we value efficiency, we look at curiosity as being unproductive. Because unless it's going to have a direct outcome, or it's going to have a direct benefit or a direct return, it's not really worth my time. So when I believe that all leaders need to have this sort of foresight capability. I don't think it's in the realm of a futurist. I think with the pace of change, the convergence of trends, the increasing challenges within the market and operating environment, all leaders need to have this foresight capability. But as I said, it's sometimes seen as, and that curiosity that underpins it is seen as being inefficient or slowing things down because, well, what happens if I start to plan for a scenario and the scenario doesn't manifest? And the point is not getting it right. The point is being ready.
Mm. So I think my three questions are all coming together now anyway. We talked about the history of futurists. So you were at PwC.
Mm.
In a strategy role, and then it led to the future of work, or how did this happen for you?
Other way around. So I was in my background was in people strategy, workforce strategy. I mean, yeah. If you go before that, my qualification was in marketing and consumer behavior. So right. For me, it's always been the psychology and behavior of people has always been what's really
yes.
fascinated and driven me. It started out looking at that in terms of, people as consumers and buyers. Why do they buy what they buy? And my honors thesis, which sounds a little bit silly, but was super interesting, was this whole idea of why do people spend, X amount of dollars on a premium brand of bottled water, as opposed to just buying a home brand alternative, because water is water. It's a utility. So brand is important. Why did someone pay that price differential? Mm. So that the consumer behavior piece really drove me. Then as I went into the workplace, I started in a strategy or consulting organization, a strategy house. And that was quite interesting because I was based in Canberra at the time, and the organization basically did 90% IT tech strategy consulting and 10% people consulting. Mm. And so going into there, I was like, well, I'm not a tech person, so I guess that kind of leaves me the people stuff. And I loved it because it was people strategy was, again, looking at like organizational behavior. Mm. Like how and why do people behave within organizations? Looking at, the role and function of leaders and the influence that they have within companies. And so started on that journey. Fast forward, working through the public sector, private sector, going into senior executive roles. And it was always driven by that. But then, you know, from a functional perspective, it then sort of evolved into, well, you know, what's the kind of workforce that we're going to need in 3 to 5 years' time? What are the kind of skills and capabilities? You know, even 10 years ago, we were talking about build, buy, borrow, bot. So this idea of, do we grow capability? Do we bring in it as contractors? Do we automate it? Do we invest in upskilling our people? And that sort of then evolved into the future of work.
Yeah.
That came out as a discipline, or emerged as a discipline, I should say. And because I am inherently a curious person, for me, that really attracted me, because it was still the work I was always doing. But then, going back to my point earlier around this convergence of different trends, all of a sudden it's not just, you know, people strategy in the context of HR. It's, you know, people strategy merged with, well, what's happening around property and real estate, because, you know, hybrid working and where people work, and what does that mean around your property portfolio? A lot to do with tech and working with the IT departments and functions, because naturally we're talking about AI and automation, but then also systems like ERPs that are really helping us to do the streamline and you know, find efficiencies and redefine ways of working. So I kind of was in that future of workspace. It was right place, right time. And then, yeah, at PwC, they made a strategic decision that they wanted to be known for that.
Yeah.
That was my jam. So yeah, I then played a sort of, I was the head of future of work at PwC. But then I guess going back to sort of what I was saying around going from people consulting or people strategy to the future of work. Similarly, I was talking about the future of work, and I'm going, well, now increasingly we can't talk about the future of work without talking about climate change, without talking about trust, without talking about, you know, consumers, because increasingly, you know, with people being more transient and mobile in the workplace, our workers are our consumers and vice versa. You know, they buy our products, they work for us. So that intersection between employee value proposition and consumer value proposition. And that's kind of where I went broader. And I was bored during COVID, so I did a whole heap of online learning and study and accreditations to be a futurist rather than just someone who specializes in the future of work.
In the future of work. Interesting. Thank you. I love that build, buy, borrow, bot. Isn't that interesting that people were talking about that a long time ago?
Mm.
And there could be a misconception that that's a real and now kind of issue.
Well, even to give you another example, right? So I had an interview with a journo the other day, and she asked me the question around how what she's observing is that leaders in organizations are finding it really challenging or difficult to have challenging conversations. Mm. And she said, you know, is that something you're observing? What's driving that? And I said, that was a conversation that was being had when I entered as a junior working within HR. And it's a conversation that is still being had today. I think the drivers behind why have changed, and I think that it has gotten more pronounced, but a lot of these things are the same things that we've been talking about for a very long time.
And we can just overlay what's happening now.
Yeah.
So leaders could say, well, it's difficult to have difficult conversations in the workplace because of the multi-generational workforce.
Yeah. And also, like, that, you know, you think about all the different legislation that comes through. So recently the right to disconnect, or you've got certain organizations that are looking at 4-day work weeks, and you know, you've got you know, well-being has become a much more pronounced part of the conversation within organizations, and leaders have this really complex role whereby they're sort of getting top-down pressure from the organization around productivity and performance, but then bottom up, they're the ones who understand, you know, that one of their team members is a single parent who's trying to juggle childcare, and someone else is caring for elderly parents, and, you know, who are suffering declining dementia, and, you know, and so I kind of think about it as like the pinch point in the hourglass, and so it is really bloody hard, and I absolutely sympathize or empathize with people who are in that position, and that it's the complexity, it's the legislative sort of ambiguity, because with so much legislation coming, the everyday middle manager within an organization, they don't live and breathe that. They're not industrial relations professionals. And then there's declining trust between the manager and the system within the organization. And what I mean by that is there's this idea that's out there that if I'm worried that I'll say or do the wrong thing, and then what happens if I get a complaint made about me, or what happens if, you know, something comes about with Fair Work and I'm not confident that my company is going to fully support me through that. And so there's so much that sort of underpins that, or that sort of surrounds that. So, but again, that talks to the world and the business environment that we're operating in, increasingly complex, increasingly volatile, increasingly uncertain.
You talked earlier on about mega trends, and we've kind of touched on AI. Other than AI, or can you say that? What are the loudest mega trends?
I'll let you say that you can talk about more than AI.
Thank you. I've seen you talk about more than AI.
Well, I think it's important. I think it's easy to sort of focus in on the big shiny thing, and it is a very big shiny thing. Yeah. But as you said, it's more than just that. I think there are a couple of other ones that I'm really paying attention to. So one of them, I think demographic change in generations is really interesting. So, you know, if I think about more the here and now, you know, we often hear about, you know, five generations in the workplace, et cetera. But, you know, we also have Gen Alpha who entered the workplace for the first time this year. Gen Beta were born on January 1st this year. We still have builders who are the generation more senior to baby boomers. There are still builders in the workplace today. So that's, you know, the generational complexity is more than I think what people appreciate. But, you know, as much as we can talk about generations, my whole shtick is, you know, that the generations is the framing, but generationless thinking is the solution, because it's not about stereotypes and putting people in boxes. It's about understanding everyone as an individual and where they're at, and embedding flexibility, not just in how we work, but also in how we lead and manage. So I think there's a lot within that. And if I look at the demographics more specifically and kind of paint a longer term picture for you. So if we look at, okay, I'm going to take you on like a very like quick economics lesson, but I'm no economics expert. Okay. So I'm
or a magician, you neither.
Well, yeah. You could say I'm a magician now. I do have performance credentials. Yeah. But no, so I think some people, when I say economics, they're kind of deer in the headlights. I'm like, no, if I can understand it, you can understand.
All right.
So when we talk about economic growth, we often talk about three key things that drive economic growth. So one is participation, so the amount of working age people who are active in the workforce. In terms of workforce participation, it's plateaued for quite some time in Australia. It's sort of at its ceiling. So participation is not something we can rely on to drive economic growth. The other one is, or the second one is productivity, which we hear a lot about. And productivity growth has actually declined in Australia over the last 20 years, which is quite fascinating. So a lot of people think automation, AI, it's going to give us all these productivity gains. Over the last 20 years, we've still grown, but at such a small rate, and that rate of growth has declined. So
why?
Because as humans, we tend to just create stuff. Like, so if we, what I mean by that is think about the amount of times you've seen a new system or a new something come into play at work. And then it's promised that it's going to make things more streamlined, and it's going to make things better and faster, and we won't need as many people to do it. And then 3 years later, you look back on it and you're like, we still have just as many people. Yeah. We didn't really realize those efficiency gains that we said that we would, because we create more stuff. The other thing is that productivity is a flawed metric. Productivity is output over time. And if you think about the, you know, the production line and the factory model, then you're producing widgets. So, you know, you produce 20 widgets in an hour. The next week you produce 22 widgets in an hour. There's productivity growth. But when we're knowledge workers, you know, and we're increasingly doing stuff with our brains, and it's not how quickly you can do something, because work is becoming more strategic, more, you know, cognitively intense. We need to think about it longer. That is not productivity's friend on paper. So productivity is murky, but we can't rely on productivity to drive economic growth.
So participation, productivity.
Good to see you with me. You did better than I did when you asked about the futurist thing and I forgot the three things.
Yeah.
So the third thing is population.
Right.
So we need our population to grow. That's the final lever that we have. If you look at our fertility rate in Australia, so the average female has 1.5 birth on average, right? We need that to be 2.1 in order to sustain our population on births alone. So 1.5, we're sitting well below that, which is quite consistent though with a lot of other developed countries. So that means the only way that we can grow our population is through migration. If we aren't going to see an uplift in our participation rate, so the amount of people who are able to work, then that means it's not just sort of migration writ large, it's skilled migrants. We want working age skilled migrants to come to Australia. And the bulk of those working age migrants are in middle income countries like the Philippines, Indonesia, and India. So we're going to see a lot of people from those middle-income countries migrate to Australia to help fill some of the worker shortage gaps. Currently, there's a forecast that suggests we'll have a shortage of 600,000 workers in 10 years' time. So we're going to need those skilled migrants to do some of that work. We're also going to need AI to do some of that work as well. People talk about AI coming to take our jobs. We need AI to take some of our jobs. And so why I tell you that is that not only are we going to have an aging population with the declining fertility rate, you know, by 2050, one in four Australians will be aged over 65, including millennials in that figure. So not only are we going to have an aging population, we're going to be a much more multicultural population today as well. And when I say a much more multicultural population today, that's on top of the baseline whereby 30% of people living and working in Australia today were born overseas. Almost one in three of us were born overseas today. That's not sort of going back two, three generations, right? If you look at the census that's going to take place next year, India is going to overtake the UK as being the largest migrant population in Australia. And so we're going to be far more multicultural, far more diverse, you know, age diverse, ethnically diverse, not just in our communities, but in our workplaces as well. And I think that's going to be you know, that's going to present, in my view, so much opportunity. But there will be challenges that come with that as well. You know, when I talk to organizations, they often talk about the aging workforce as a risk. And I just go, it's a reality. It's not a risk. Yeah, a risk is something you want to mitigate against.
It's
how do we avoid it happening?
Predictable. Yeah.
It's predictable. And why is it a bad thing? And this is, I guess, goes to, sort of a frustration I have, but I understand it's a frustration of someone who's not living through it. But the frustration I have is that so many leaders, they just, it's as if they pick up sort of, you know, let's take hybrid working. So many leaders picked up what happened face to face, whacked it online, and you know, were perplexed that they, you know, it didn't work and function the same. And similarly, when it comes to something like, you know, an aging workforce, or when it comes to increasing levels of ethnic diversity and multicultural diversity in our workplaces, it requires a different way of thinking. Not just a different way of thinking, we also need to redesign parts of the system. So when we think about older workers, you know, it means we have to, you know, it's not about the 9-to-5 full-time worker who sits in that role and they're at this level and they progress through the organization. How do you support or better support pathways of transitioning to retirement, or retirement and then coming out of retirement? Or how do you create roles whereby they're not structured roles that are delivering or producing widgets, but maybe it's a role whereby you've got a very tenured and senior leader who has all of that tacit corporate knowledge? How do you create a role where they're just a mentor? You know, and we would go, well, I would never pay someone to just be a mentor. That's something that's a nice to have that you do on top of the role that I'm paying you for. But that's where we need to start to pull apart what is work, how do we design jobs, and maybe do it a little bit differently. But that's hard and that's threatening, because we like to kind of do things mostly the same with a little bit of tweaking around the edges and keep doing that continuous improvement, little sort of step change, rather than anything that's big, bold and transformative.
Comes back to curiosity.
Mm.
So we started with curiosity and signals, and then we've just finished with big, bold and transformative.
Mm.
There is so much we could be talking about here.
Yeah.
And I think fundamentally leaders have succeeded on their instinct and their judgment from experience.
Yeah.
And I think what you've brought to this conversation today, Ben, has been some perspectives, and some of them quite different.
Mm.
And even that idea of where we are, of strategy of 1 to 3 years, and this is the plan, we're going bold, we're going big. But for someone really talking about 10 years out, I mean, we haven't even scraped the surface of this conversation today, but it's been really interesting. And I've learned a lot, and I'm curious for more. Ben Hamer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So that's it for Vistage Live today. Thank you for joining us. Make sure you subscribe so you can listen to us each episode. And for more information about Vistage, check us out on vistage.com.au.